Shlach.
Welcome back, Jason. Say hello to Jason, everyone, if you don't know. Okay, so some interesting Rashi's in Shlach. Let's start from at the beginning, but let's work sequentially. Moshe instructs them to enter from the south. Now, that's obvious. They're in the south. They're not going to circumvent Israel and enter from the north. They're southerly. And so Rashi believes that Moshe's directions contain not just coordinates and geographical ways instructions, because they don't need that for Moshe, but a desired itinerary that Moshe feels is important beyond just logistics. So what does Moshe say? The south is generally, as we know, it's the less fertile, the less quality. Good morning, Yonatan. The less quality land. And as you make your way northerly in Eretz Yisrael, the land becomes progressively more fertile, in particular as you make your way towards Yerushalayim. That's part of the way that Am Yisrael is expected to see Eretz Yisrael. So Moshe essentially wants them to encounter the worst part of Israel, Haluzeh Banegev, before, even though it would be obvious, but he restates it, before they encounter the better parts. Now, why would that be? Wouldn't you want people to walk in and first see the beauty and first see the spectacle and the marvel? So Rashi tells us, well, at least in those days, that's the way that peddlers, that's the way that store owners and salesmen would operate. First, they throw out a couple, let's say, inferior, subpar items, and then they build up your interest, and they catch you, and they say, you know, here's something really special. They threw out the special item initially, you maybe won't appreciate it. So there's a way of contrast. Here, take a look at this, but if you really want something special, you know, here's the fancy stuff. Here's the fancy merchandise. And that's the way that at least peddlers operate. Maybe today things have changed, but in a peddling environment, we have to sell. Salesmanship means you slowly and incrementally build interest. Now, what's the assumption in Rashi? That Moshe is a salesman. Basically, Moshe is trying to sell Eretz Yisrael. He's trying to choreograph their travel through Eretz Yisrael in a way that they'll be excited, similarly to a person in the marketplace. So essentially, Moshe's playing the role of peddler, saying, this is what I want you to see first, and when you're finished, you'll see something really special. Now, you wouldn't expect that Moshe has to peddle Eretz Yisrael. You'd feel that Eretz Yisrael could sell itself. This is the land of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Or HaKadosh Baruch Hu could sell the land. Why is Moshe acting as a peddler, as a salesman, as a marketer, as a merchandiser? The answer is, yes, we have to sell Eretz Yisrael. And as much as you would think that it's the land of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it's the type of land that it should sell itself, human beings have to sell Eretz Yisrael, and not everyone will. This is the theme of Parsha Shlach. Not everyone will accept that gift. And it speaks a lot to Israel advocacy, and speaks a lot of when I say advocacy, I don't just mean in a political, you know, on campus, it's normally used to battle Palestinian propaganda. I mean to talk nicely and kindly about Eretz Yisrael, to make people fall in love with Eretz Yisrael. I wrote about this in an article this week in the OU about not complaining about life in Eretz Yisrael, not over-complaining about life in Eretz Yisrael, not falling into the pessimism of the Meraglim and the bitterness of the Meraglim. So it's interesting that Moshe Rabbeinu senses, even at this early stage, that he has to structure their journey as if he's trying to sell Eretz Yisrael to them. Okay, let's find another interesting Rashi. When they get to Eretz Yisrael, they find very, very tall people. Now, it sounds like the land is full of tall people, because everywhere they went, they felt like grasshoppers. The grasshopper effect, famous name is grasshopper effect, where you project your fear into other people's eyes. They never interviewed the residents, how do you see us? They just assumed they were being seen as grasshoppers because they felt like grasshoppers. A famous, famous psychological Rashi. But the Torah specifically itemizes v'sham ra'inu as hanafilim b'nei anak min hanafilim. Right, listen to that cadence. As hanafilim b'nei anak min hanafilim. A lot of words used to describe giants. And not only, it sounds like these are children of giants. They're b'nei anak. So they're double giants. And the children, can you imagine if Andre the Giant, and we're going back to our generation, the famous wrestler, he married, let's say, his counterpart, so they'd be even taller, he and his wife, Mrs. Giant, had little giant children. So this is b'nei anak. These are children of giants. So Rashi says, yeah, we're not interested in their parents and the children. These were not children of giants. Rashi defines them, identifies them. Who are these people? Anakim mipnei sham chazoi v'azael. These are the children of the giants in Sefer Bereishis. Shenaflu min hashamayim v'imei dor enosh. Okay, so if I'm following my years correctly, I don't really know when b'nei enosh happened, but let's say it happened before Noach, right? Sounds that way. It's in the end of Sefer Bereishis. So this is, at the very, very least, about 1,000 years ago. You see, Ezra's time is 2448. Noah's about 16-something. So, but probably happened a lot before Noah. It sounds like that's part of the reason that there was a moral degeneration and moral deterioration that led to Noah. We talk about 1,000 years, 1,200 years, 1,500 years earlier. This is fascinating. Whoever heard of these people? We're in the middle of Sefer Bereishis. We're in Shlach now. We're close to the end of the Torah. And all of a sudden, the children of... By the way, we have the names that we don't have in Bereishis. Sham Chazai Va'azael Shenefle Min HaShemayim. So part of the answer is, yeah, we're returning to Sefer Bereishis. We're returning to Sefer Bereishis. The world was created so that Am Yisrael should inhabit Eretz Yisrael and represent Hashem. Bishvil Yisrael Shenek Bereishis, the first Rashi in the Torah. Why does the Torah describe Bias HaOlam, even though we don't really know what happened? The Kodesh Baruch Hu says, I will determine who will live in Eretz Yisrael. I will determine who won't live in Eretz Yisrael. And so we are returning to Bereishis. And this is, you have to read Shlach as a continuation of Bereishis. I don't know why the Torah chooses Dafka the Giants. I'll talk about that in a second. But Kodesh Baruch Hu wants us to see Shlach as a sequel to Bereishis, not only as a sequel to Balascha. To create that textual juxtaposition. Now what's also interesting is that this Pasuk and this Rashi is highlighting that, and where did the giants go? Let's face it. I mean, the giants, let's say they lived in Eretz Yisrael, but presumably they lived elsewhere. Where else did they, what happened to the giants in the other areas? They died. When did they die? During the mass extinction. And what was the mass extinction? Not the meteor that hit the earth, but the Mabul. Everyone dies in the Mabul, and everything gets changed through the Mabul. So the world of Bereishis and Noach is no longer around in Balascha and Shlach, because the world has been completely altered, except for Og, who has a historical role to play in Jewish history to conquer the land from Og, so we can take the land from Og. That's why he saved from the Mabul. But according to Chazal, which land was untouched by the Mabul? Eretz Yisrael. According to Chazal, when the Yonah tries to find the Alei Zayis, it travels to Eretz Yisrael and it returns. So highlighting that the people of Bereishis are still alive in Eretz Yisrael is not just a way to demonstrate that Shlach is the continuation of Bereishis because Hashem wants Am Yisrael to be in the land, that's why he created the world, but also this is a land that was untouched by the Mabul. This is a prehistoric land. It still has its original potential, its original divine creation. This is not the Model 2, Version 2 land that was recreated. And so much so that all those giants who went extinct in other lands, if they ever got there, but in Eretz Yisrael, the Mabul didn't. They're still there. So the people of Bereishis and the land of Bereishis are still there from Sefer Bereishis when they enter Eretz Yisrael. These are very, very nuanced Rashis, but they're fascinating once you start thinking about them. Okay. Another interesting Rashi. Who stands there and finally quiets them down? Vayas Kolev Esam. So actually, Rashi talks about this twice. Once in the beginning, Vayas Kolev Esam, the beginning of Pasuk Lamed. And then in the end, Rashi returns and tells us, why is it Lashon Shtika? So he quotes several Pesukim in Tanakh, two in particular, which word Has. It's a strange word. Has Kol Basam Rifnei Hashem. Has Ki Lo Lahaskir. And then Rashi gives an explanation. He doesn't just show parallels or analogs in Tanakh. He says, why does the word has mean to quiet? Because it's onomatopoeia, Rashi says. When people quiet, people screaming, shh, shh, has, has, whether they're two different versions in Rashi. Either they say has, has, or they say shh, shh. Either way, we don't really know. It's culturally contextual. How did they quiet one another 2,000 years? I don't know if they said shh, or they said has. But obviously, the two of them make a difference. Has sounds enough like shh. So now the question becomes, why does the Torah use an onomatopoeia? There are very few onomatopoeias in Tanakh. Here's an onomatopoeia. Why is the Torah, at this point in Shlach, using a word to describe Kalev's quieting of the rebels 3,000 years ago that sounds like you're quieting someone? The answer is because the Torah is not just describing what happened 3,000 years ago, but it's trying to create an effect that's happening now by saying a word that even today, Vayas. So who is the Torah? It's not just Kalev quieted, but the Torah, by writing the word, not just describing what Kalev did, but I say, you ran. So when I say you ran, I'm not running, because I'm describing a word that has nothing to do with experience. But if I use a word to describe you running that sounds like running, then I'm running, because I'm using a word that sounds like running. So the Torah describes Kalev's quieting of the people thousands of years ago with a word that sounds like the Torah itself is quieting. Who is the Torah quieting? All the skeptics and all the complainers and all the people that are Israel. Namely, the Torah recognizes that the Meraglim is not just a one-off event, but our relationship to Eretz Yisrael and our ability to believe in Eretz Yisrael, even though there's so much adversity when trying to conquer Eretz Yisrael and settle Eretz Yisrael, it's not. The Meraglim are still alive. The Nesi'im aren't there, but the mentality and the challenge of living in the land of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and facing all these frightening experiences, and that leading us to don't move to Eretz Yisrael. And I mean, it's not just the obvious issues. There are some real issues. I don't just mean people that are pernicious, that are malicious about Eretz Yisrael. For example, I'll just talk about something I spoke about yesterday with the girls. There are many Rebbeim, and I'm not indicting them. I'm just saying that this is built into the process. There are many Rebbeim in America who are now telling families not to make Aliyah. Why are they telling families not to make Aliyah? Because as you may have noticed, it's not so easy to keep your kids firm when you make Aliyah. A lot of Americans and Anglos who have made Aliyah, their kids are no longer a dati. For all the reasons which we're not going to talk about right now because it's a larger conversation. And a lot of Rebbeim are saying, don't make Aliyah because you have to protect the firm kind of your kids. Now, I'm not saying where I fall on that. It's a real question. You know, how you respond to that question is an interesting, again, beyond this conversation. But the struggle to live in Eretz Yisrael and the adversity in Eretz Yisrael is not just the classic, the enemies and the security, the economy, we can't afford. Living in Eretz Yisrael will always be a struggle, and people will always turn their attention away from Eretz Yisrael. Hopefully, again, this is a very sincere, I'm not comparing that to the Baragla, I'm just saying that it will always be a process. So the Torah employs a word that sounds like it's not just describing what Kali performed thousands of years ago, but the Torah itself is saying, quiet, quiet, stop making fun of Eretz Yisrael, stop deriding Eretz Yisrael. One more Rashi, since we have a little more time today. Okay, interesting Rashi. Let's turn a little bit until when Moshe davens. So what does Moshe say? He says, "V'shamu Mitzrayim kelisa b'chofachas amazem ikirba." That if you don't take Am Yisrael to Eretz Yisrael, the Egyptians are going to hear. And what are they going to say? V'amru el yoshev ha'aretz hazos. And they'll speak about the Canaanim, that the Canaanim were too strong. So the Egyptians will all go bet on the Canaanim over HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They make a lot of money. So the Egyptians will ridicule you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Who cares about the Egyptians? The Egyptians we cared about them during the Egel. During the Egel, we just left Egypt a few months earlier. We still were close to Egypt. What happened in the desert, Egypt would hear about, probably no one else, because we're in the middle of a desert. We're still in touch with our Egyptian friends, any WhatsApps or whatever, through our mouth. So when Moshe davens for the Egel, against the Egel destruction, says, Lama Yamur Mitzrayim Berot Siam Largos Amberim. But now it's, well, someone on the doorstep of Eretz Yisrael, we're closer to Eretz Yisrael than we are to Mitzrayim. We're right near Kadesh Barnea. So the concern should be, now what the Egyptians will say about the people of Eretz Canaan vis-a-vis their strength relative to Kadesh Baruch Hu, but what the Canaanim will say about you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What's this? The Egyptians will say that the Canaanim were too strong, but you're not concerned the Canaanim will walk around parading and scorning and presenting themselves as stronger than HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the truth is, there's another Pasuk, two Pesukim later, that they'll say, let me find the Pasuk. Wow, it's hard with all this drilling. Okay? V'amru ha-goyim asher shemu ha-shimucha le'mor, that all the nations will say. And the Evan Ezra says, that pasuk, v'amru ha-goyim, is not just the Egyptians, but the Canaanim. But you can't avoid that the first pasuk and Moshe's primary concern is, what will the Egyptians say about the Canaanim and their strength compared to HaKadosh Baruch Hu Chas V'Shalom and Am Yisrael? And the answer is, it sounds like that the Egyptians, for all of their sexual promiscuity and the moral breakdown, they still are a people of culture. And as a people of culture, they're leading the civilization of the day, and they can be trained. You remember the Makos and Kriyas Yamsef were educational sessions for the Mitzrayim, to demonstrate the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so that they will then pass this on to other nations of the world. We don't see it that way because it took thousands of years till the nations of the world were able to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu, monotheism, even corrupted forms of monotheism such as Christianity, and to a lesser degree Islam, it's still a positive development in the evolution of people's ability to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it happens in Egypt. Egypt is a major, major cultural center for thousands of years. So the Egyptians are educationable. They could be educated. They could be redeemed. They're evidently not so deeply mired into the world of paganism that they're unredeemable. Why is that true? It's interesting. Maybe it's because they were technologically advanced, because the Egyptians were also scientists. So maybe once you start employing ration and reason, then you're able to think and you're able to debunk paganism. So the Egyptians, for all the Avodah Zarah that we meet and all the sexual promiscuity that we hear about in Bereishis, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has an interest in teaching them. That's why they're a Makos, maybe because they lived with us for several hundred years. So by living side by side, they picked up a few things from us. They talked with us about Avmi Yitzchak and Yaakov. And therefore, Moshe saying, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this is your educational project, to educate Egypt and through Egypt, the rest of the world. Those Canaan, who cares what they say? Moshe is not saying the Canaan will start to ridicule, because the Canaan, again, we know they're going to be annihilated. And if you put why? Why they annihilated? Because they're not educationable. They can't be trained to see you. So Moshe is more concerned with the Egyptians, what they'll say about this face-off with the Canaan, and less concerned with the Canaan, who are basically standing right there. They're over there eavesdropping. They're listening to Moshe and Yakadosh Baruch Hu. They can hear Moshe say this. And I'm not concerned about the Canaan, because they're just savage, nomadic warriors who are roaming the land, killing each other, drinking each other's blood. Remember, in Egypt, no one's drinking blood. How do you know they didn't drink blood? Makas Dam. If you drink blood, then you can drink each other's blood. It's not a big deal, right? Blood is, I mean, not being a vampire, but I can imagine blood is contained in a lot of water. So in theory, at a certain point, you could subside a little bit. The Egyptians don't want to, they don't want to touch each other's blood. They had to sell, they were drinking each other's blood. So the Egyptians can be retrained. The Canaanim can't, and therefore Moshe says, these are your target audience. You have to be careful about spinning it properly for the target audience. So Moshe is a peddler. He has to sell Eretz Yisrael. We see the giants living in Eretz Yisrael because it's still Sefer Bereishis. This is part of the Sefer Bereishis narrative, and this land is still pristine and primordial. Moshe Kalim, sorry, quiets the people, and the Torah also quiets the people today. And then finally, Moshe is more concerned. He tells us the Kadosh Baruch Hu, not with what the Canaanim will say, but what the Egyptians will say. Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom. Okay. Good morning.